amigos y bienvenidos a este vuestro programa Dos Gatos en Tierra de Perros. Un podcast de actualidad donde analizamos de manera fáctica y neutral las noticias más relevantes de la política y cultura norteamericana.
Hello, I'm Joe Magaja. Thank you, friends, for being with me for another episode of Dos Gatos en Tierra de Perros. Today, I have with me the prestigious writer, Kelly Vlahos. Welcome, Kelly.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you for calling me prestigious. I appreciate that.
Well, no, I mean it. And I wanted to ask you, I have so many questions to ask you because it's been a crazy time, a wild couple of weeks, and an even wilder 2 years for one side of the campaign and 3 months for another side. But now that it's over with, even though there are still votes coming in and people are saying that it wasn't so much of a mandate, that, you know, it's closer than people thought. I think it was a mandate in my own personal opinion, but I could be projecting. I think it was a mandate not only about our economy, but also about the endless wars that we have overseas. What do you think of the recent proposed appointments that Trump has brought to the table? And will they possibly bring an end to the war in Ukraine and in Gaza? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there are two different things going on there. I'm a little disappointed with Trump's picks. They are not coming from the realism and restraint vein of his support base, which I would put under the J.D. Vance category. I think they're more coming from the hawkish pro-Israel direction. And unfortunately, that doesn't bode well for the future of U.S. policy with Israel and in respect to Gaza and Lebanon and the region. And so I think we really have to hold out some hope that Donald Trump will want to see peace. The question is, how is that executed? And right now, with people like Mike Huckabee playing U.S. ambassador to Israel and Mike Waltz as national security advisor and Marco Rubio as the new secretary of state, that doesn't bode well because they're very heavily pro-Israel, very anti-Iran. Mike Huckabee has basically said there's no such thing as Palestine. And so that gives you a little idea of where they're going to come down, and it's firmly on the side of Israel in any future negotiations or resolve of that conflict. On the other side, I think there has been an all-around support among the Republican base, and that includes the realism and restraint, but also the hawks as well, to end the war in Ukraine. So I think you'll probably see some movement on that. What shape that will take is anyone's guess. I think there are people within the Trump orbit, like Elon Musk, like J.D. Vance, who see a negotiated settlement as the only way to get out of this war. And so you're going to see some movement in that direction. Like I said, not sure what shape that's going to take. Overall, I do think that Donald Trump has a strong feeling, impetus for getting out of endless wars, not engaging in more democracy building, nation building, regime change for the benefit of promoting our idea of a U.S.-led world order. So that might be a good thing. He is more transactional. He does see things pretty realistically in terms of who our enemies are and who our allies are and where U.S. interests sort of fit into all of that. Let's just hope better angels win out in terms of like how we conduct these transactions, whether or not our new relations or existing relations with other countries will result in more peaceful order as opposed to more instability in places like the Middle East, for example, or in Europe. And you know, we have issues going on, wars, conflicts in Africa, and there's all sorts of political instability in Latin America. So where Trump and the United States fit into all this is a question now, because the world is changing, and it's changing regardless of Trump or Biden or left or right. I think the international stage is sort of like shifting, and we're not necessarily the center of it anymore. And so it'll be up to us on how to gracefully sort of adapt to the new world order, and whether Trump can do that or at least bridge us to the next chapter. I think that's anyone's guess. And as somebody who's more of an independent thinker, I run a transpartisan website, Responsible Statecraft. I don't have, I'm not forwarding an agenda for a particular party or person or ideology. So like I'm as hopeful as anyone else, but also a little wary of what's happening and what will happen next.
Yeah, there were multiple coups over the past year in Africa, including Burkina Faso and, oh gosh, I can't think of the other countries. I should know. Gabon, was that one of them? Or
Niger, yeah.
In Niger, yeah. And there was, I think just this past week, there was another assassination attempt at the leader of Burkina Faso. And I know that basically there's this whole BRICS movement, which, depending on who you talk to, basically establishment people keep telling me it's nothing. It's just a promise that's not going to lead to anything. But it seems to be getting stronger and stronger, with more countries having an interest in it, countries in Africa, countries in Latin America. In fact, I read not long ago that in some parts of Bolivia, they're even accepting yuan as currency. Hopefully... Yeah, I'm wondering how Trump is going to deal with all that, because I think he is focused on business and industry, and I think hopefully that will lower the tensions with the whole Taiwan issue. We're so dependent on Taiwan because of the computer chips, et cetera. But how do you think that's going to progress, or do you have an idea of it seems to be moving fairly quickly now? It's been building for a few years, BRICS, and now it seems to have gotten some more momentum. And yeah, I'm wondering how that's going to go. What do you think?
I mean, there are people much smarter than I on this subject, but you know, from the 30,000 foot view, I think what you're seeing is a lot of countries that have been subjected to U.S. sanctions, to international sanctions, and I'm looking at Iran here, North Korea, Russia, Venezuela, and then secondary sanctions. I mean, we have led this sort of like punitive regime against countries that do not toe the line, that do not agree with us, that do things that we don't like. And the apex of that was Russia and their invasion of Ukraine. Now, the Quincy Institute, for whom I work for, we're, you know, in support of those initial sanctions for the illegal invasion of Ukraine, which was a violation of international law. But the idea that we could continue to sanction beyond anything that we've seen in the history of sanctions, And then expect sort of a change in what they're doing and a resolve of that conflict was futile. Russia's only gotten stronger. Their economy has not collapsed due to these sanctions, and we have not learned the lessons. And what's happening, like you said, are these countries that are starting to coalesce with each other in order to end run the sanctions that we have imposed. So what you're having is this, like you said, this alternative financial system is starting to grow. And it's not only built on the de-dollarization or the efforts towards that, but also this idea that other countries could start working together as a hedge against us. Now, does that mean that they're going to unalign or literally put themselves up as a resistance? Some may, yes, like Russia. But others are just actually just looking out for their own interests and not completely cutting off ties with the United States, because they do have strong trade relations. They have financial relations. I mean, this is a globalized system. But like countries like India, they're not going to completely break from Russia or China or the United States. What they're doing is forming alliances forming relationships and partnerships that don't necessarily are not either aligned or not aligned with the U.S.-led order. And what is that happening to the U.S.-led order? It's just it's diminishing it. And I think most people who have been watching this for years acknowledge this as a new multipolar reality. The question is, will the United States gracefully adjust to this new reality, or will it continue to try to throw its weight around by impressing more sanctions, bullying our European allies and partners into doing the same? I'm not sure. It looks like Europe is starting to get a little bit of a shock in terms of the repercussions of the sanctions that they supported on Russia, which has hurt energy prices. It has hurt their economies, particularly in Germany. And they're starting to talk in a different language about the future of the Ukraine war and about sanctions. So it might be that they start adjusting a little better than we to this new reality. But I think I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I think after 70 years of the post-World War II consensus, where the United States would lead everyone into this new liberal world order, and somehow it was, you know, bad guys versus good guys, and then the entire globalization had sort of built up around that, and then we saw that collapse. And now we're seeing the security situation collapse, and the United States is kind of, you know, it kind of the scales have been ripped from the situation or the eyes of the world, because we aren't infallible. We have supported regimes that are illiberal when it is politically convenient, and then pressed and bullied others when we don't like what they're doing. And people are looking at us and they're going, yeah, your credibility is a little shot, particularly after what's happening in Gaza. And, you know, we can find ways around you. And I think that's what's happening.
Yeah, I agree. I had Jeffrey Brodsky on recently, and he's the only journalist, as far as I know, who visited all the sites of the Nord Stream 2 and Nord Stream 1 pipeline. And he explained to me all the investigations that he did, and that basically all evidence leads to Rome, leads to us. You know, basically all roads lead to us. You know, it sounds like we're the ones that blew up the pipeline, which kind of makes it crazy, because Germany is trying to be as much of a cheerleader for us as possible. But at the same time, we really put them in a bad situation. We destroyed their source of gas, natural gas, and now they're receiving gas from us through ships, liquid gas at extremely high prices. So that benefits us, but it doesn't really benefit them. And Europe, much like the United States, is not doing well economically right now. So do you think there's going to be a shift there now that also a lot of people are turning away from mainstream media? Because that's the thing, the Cold War worked well because we could follow this narrative that was fed to us by the mainstream media, you know, the axis of evil and all that. Now we can see behind the scenes, and we see that we're not so nice either. What do you think?
I mean, I think we're getting, I mean, as I sort of hinted before, I think we're getting to an era in which nations are going to start looking more out for themselves. And that would include European nations, the European project under the EU, all of the global South in terms of, and you know, you can't talk about these countries or these regions as a monolith. There are plenty of countries that you would consider inside the global South that are very leftist. They're very socialist minded. And then you have others that are very much more conservative fiscally and traditionally. And this is a very dynamic time, and I think the United States is going to have to start doing that too. And you see the impetus for that in the election, where conservative voters or populist voters for Trump felt like he was speaking more to the U.S. national interest when it came to foreign policy. Now, does he have a well-thought-out doctrine of foreign policy? Absolutely not. But one of the things that helped him, propelled him to the presidency in 2016 was his criticism of the global war on terror. And as you'll probably remember, he said, we can no longer be the world's policeman. We need to get out of these regime change world wars. We need to redirect our attention back to the United States. We have to think about ourselves and what's best for us. He didn't say dismantle the military, be isolationist. On the contrary, he's been very vocal about rebuilding the military and making it the most lethal, effective fighting force ever. I have disagreements with some of the people around him and how they think that can happen. But I think what he's saying is we don't disregard the importance of the military and national defense, but no longer are we going to use that to go out in search of monsters to destroy and tell other countries how to live. And so I think that really resonated with Americans on a broad level. I think that the era of this sort of internationalism, this idea that we use the military to spread democracy and make other countries look like us, and I use that in air quotes because looking like us, God knows what that looks like right now because we are just so hypocritical on the world stage. But this ideal of this liberal order and that somehow we can use the U.S. military to enforce that, I think that that's old news. I don't think anybody really believes that anymore. I think there are a number of people within the power structures of Washington, D.C., who still live by that sort of religious mantra, and you will see them cling to power with their fingernails. But I think time has sort of surpassed them. And for some reason, it took Donald Trump to actually put his finger on the pulse of where most America was, and they're just tired of it. Now, you can call it isolationist because that's what the sort of smear is, but it really isn't. It's not saying that America can no longer trade or engage or use diplomacy or make friends or try to help resolve issues through talking and negotiations. It's just saying we don't want to use the military as the first tool in the box. And we'd rather not go to war for Israel. We'd rather not go to war for countries in the Middle East that we make defense pacts with, or Europe and be their security guarantor when they have plenty of money and they could have been building up their defenses all this time. You know, let's bring back the attention to what's happening in this country, because we got a lot of problems here, and resolving other countries' problems shouldn't be at the top of the list.
I agree. And I think that that's kind of how this campaign and how this election turned, because and it kind of became a fight between the coastal elites and the working class people. And right. The thing is that the working class people are the ones that mostly send their kids into the military, because it's an opportunity to get an education. And also in a lot of these quote unquote flyover states, there aren't a lot of jobs anymore because the factories have shut down. There's a huge problem with fentanyl and other addictions. People talk about, especially during the pandemic, people talked about the deaths of the pandemic, but they didn't talk about the rise in overdoses, the rise of suicides. I think a lot of young people feel very hopeless. And I think, oddly enough, the left has turned very hawkish in terms of the quote unquote left, because they're not really left. They're as much capitalist as the right. They're kind of two sides of the same coin. But I'm wondering, in terms of the choices that he made, like Marco Rubio, I think in his past administration, a lot of people betrayed him. Generals actually met and literally plotted against him or to not follow his orders and right. lied to his face about withdrawing troops and then didn't do it. So I'm wondering if maybe he chose Rubio and some of the others because they will follow orders. Do you think that that's the case, or do you think that they'll do their thing when they get into power?
You know, I don't know for sure because I don't have an inside line into the Trump administration. And I don't want to like, I don't want to suggest that I do. But I do think there's a little two things going on. I think one, yes, it's probably a lot about loyalty. The people that he's chosen are pretty much within the sort of range of his MAGA orbit. But I also think that there's a lot going on with the Iran and Israel question. I look at each of the people that he's chosen, and they're, like I said, they're very pro-Israel. They have connections to Israel donors like Miriam Adelson, who Marco Rubio has been very close with and has funded his campaigns in the past. Elise Stefanik, who is his UN ambassador appointee, is also super pro-Israel, has cut her teeth at a couple of think tanks that are associated with neoconservatives and a very broad anti-Iran mandate. Mike Walls also may be perfectly loyal, but also is a huge China hawk and also has been very anti-Iran. I see the Iran issue as sort of the thread line through each of these, including Michael Huckabee, his U.S. ambassador to Israel now. And that makes me think that, you know, there had been some deliberate intention to make sure, and I don't know if it was because of his relationships with Benjamin Netanyahu. I'm not sure it's not because of the enormous donations and contributions he's gotten from Miriam Adelson and other pro-Israel billionaires. But that makes me nervous because I feel like if that was the litmus test, that doesn't bode well for us in terms of staying out of a war with Iran. And I know that Israel would really love it if the United States went to war with Iran on its behalf. And it's pretty much, you know, provoked all it can in that direction up until now. And so that's, I guess, my biggest concern. I don't know beyond that, like if it's just pure loyalty or ideology. I wish, you know, I'm happy that he put Tulsi Gabbard in as his director of national intelligence, because although that she has been very, she seems to have been a lot more hawkish on the Middle East and during the campaign, overall, she is a more restrained figure in terms of like promoting the idea of getting out of endless wars and not into more regime change situations. And so that is hopeful. But I'm in terms of like formulating the policy, I'm not sure that he has put the right people in terms of, you know, what I would have hoped for, and the Quincy Institute being a big supporter of realism and restraint. Not sure it's going in that direction. I could be wrong, though. Ultimately, Donald Trump is the decider. And if he doesn't agree with his Secretary of State or National Security Advisor or his Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, who he also nominated over the last week, also a hawk on some of these issues, you know, he could just and run them as well. So this is the new Trump reality, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, I agree with you 100%. I think I'm a lot more hopeful about Ukraine ending before Israel, because basically the only thing we need to do to end Ukraine is to cut the spigot, stop sending money, stop sending arms, because we're the ones that keep it going. And NATO really won't be doing it on the European side. They don't have the money, and they also, I mean, they're suffering economically as well, but they don't have, and they're definitely, I mean, because then they might end up having to send troops, and no Europeans want to send the troops into Ukraine, I think, or most Europeans don't. Some Europeans are hawkish as well, which is crazy, but I think that there's this whole carryover from the Cold War. I mean, it's been so long, and so many, there are probably two generations that don't even remember the Cold War. I do. I was a teenager in the 80s, So I remember it well. And I lived in Spain during an attempted coup, and it was shortly after Franco had died. So I know that there's always been these tensions on both sides, but really it's more complicated than it used to be. It used to be basically right versus left. And it was all basically we'd ally with far right dictators all over the world as long as they were anti-communist.
Yep.
Now it's kind of a mix, but we still have like I just saw this past week, and I don't know if this is that reflective. Well, Lula's wife said F you to Elon Musk in a speech. Yes. And I wasn't really sure what the point of that was, but I think that that was a roundabout way of saying F you to Trump as well. And of course, you know, they're pushing BRICS and everything, and they want to become, I think, well, because Brazil is such a big country and it has so many resources, but it's not the world power that it wants to be. And they want to be on the same level with some of these other countries, and with their size and their potential, they could be, but they haven't had great leadership over the years. And they're still basically an agricultural country, right? I mean, do they have a whole lot of exports besides agriculture?
You know, one of the things that I've seen in with Brazil included is that it has been an effort over the last 10 years, or, you know, well, since Trump won, to encourage this idea that there is a global fight against authoritarianism and illiberalism. And this has made me quite nervous. And because I see a lot of the neoconservatives of the pre-Trump time, the ones who helped foment the war against Iraq and make it a global war on terrorism, now finding common cause with more left of center organizations and internationalist, organizations is sort of like the center left on this premise that it's really a fight for democracy, and it's putting folks like Trump, Putin, Viktor Orban in Hungary, Maloney in Italy, Marine Le Pen in France, and making it this global war, or at least leading to one. And I feel like Brazil has sort of been sucked into that. And one of the fronts in the war is the fight against misinformation and disinformation. And so these players in this new fight have sort of zeroed in on Elon Musk and Twitter and other forms of social media, YouTube, whatever, as a sort of a front in this war. And all they have to do is stop disinformation from spreading, and that will stop this illiberalism from spreading. And they really believe in this. And, you know, on one hand, you could say, well, you know, the party's moved on, you know, this, they can't put the genie back in the bottle in terms of social media and its influences. But what they're doing is using government powers and funding to crack down on misinformation, disinformation, and malinformation. So you saw that in the United States during, by the end of the Trump administration, the deep state, meaning his own agencies, were cracking down on Twitter and making them take down accounts they didn't like over COVID, and then the Russian influence in the 2020 election. And now you've seen this moved over to places like Brazil, in which U.S. government sources have been helping Brazil crack down on free speech in Brazil and crack down on Twitter and other forms of what they say are misinformation. So I really believe that's something to watch. We saw that in the speeches that Biden made, whether it be in the 2022 midterm elections or this election, that we are fighting for the soul of democracy. And he's not talking about, unfortunately, he's not talking about really bad autocrats and monarchs in Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which you got some really bad guys there that are funding wars in Africa and all over the place and creating instability and hanging people for bad tweets. We don't talk about those. He's just talking about Orban and Putin and all these people that have been designated as illiberals. And I don't, you know, personally, I don't think there's much salience in this. I think the rest of the world is kind of hip to this sort of trite good versus evil Manichaean conflict that they've set up. But I think that there's a lot of money in it, and I think there's a lot of political urge on behalf of like anti-Trump people. And so I would keep an eye on that. See how that coalesces and whether or not it gets more life or less in this new Trump era.
Yes, for sure. I mean, I totally agree that it's a financial thing and it's a control of information thing. Yes. So like, I mean, there's been this exodus over the past week of people going to Blue Sky, which I mean, the thing is, it's not exclusive, so you don't have to be from a specific party or anything to go on Blue Sky. I advertise this show on Blue Sky. I don't know. Maybe now that it's boosted its followers, I'll get some people saying, you know, misinformation or whatever. But I do know that even in England and the UK, they've arrested people for posts on Facebook and that kind of thing, and people are actually in jail for it. But I think, like you said, that the genie's out of the bottle, the toothpaste is out of the tube. You can't really go back in time. They are trying to control the internet to a certain extent and block websites that they say put out disinformation. And they're also trying to control currencies like cryptocurrencies, particularly partly because of their own self-interest, again, because the government wants to create its own digital currency. It sounds like within the next, I don't know how many years, maybe 10 years, they're trying to phase out cash altogether. I mean, already so many people just live off of credit cards and debit cards that people don't carry cash like they used to. And some stores don't even accept cash anymore. But I think it's really scary for a government to run a digital currency, because then, of course, they want to do that so they can track where your money goes. Yeah. And partly they claim for tax purposes, et cetera, and also to avoid illicit things like, you know, drug or human trafficking or that kind of thing. But really, that's, I think, even going back to the drug wars, going back to the 80s, this whole thing of tracking people's money was not so much about enforcing laws. It was more about controlling people. Yeah. And I think that's what they want to do now. I know that Bukele in El Salvador is accepting Bitcoin as a form of a payment, official currency. And I think that's going to go elsewhere as well. I've noticed over the past week, it's gone through the roof, you know. I wonder where that's going to go in terms of, you know, so much is digital, so much is websites, platforms such as Twitter or X now, and all these other platforms and cryptocurrency. The whole world is changing so quickly that it's hard to say where we're going to be in the next few years. And if the people that want to crack down on freedom of information, freedom of trade succeed, it almost looks Orwellian in a lot of ways, or not almost, it does look Orwellian. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I just pointing out, or at least getting back to your point about government control of the financial systems. I mean, I feel like no matter what the government wants to do, there will be a black market that sprouts up in resistance to it. And I don't think, and I don't think that's what at least the American founders had in their minds when they sort of outlined the goal of the federal government, or the mission of the federal government, to have control and to track the financial transactions of American citizens. So I do think that it is a situation where, as hard as the government tries to lock down I think that there will be a dark web or a dark financial system that will spring up, unfortunately, for law-abiding citizens who won't be tapped into any of that. Yeah, I mean, the fact that they're already surveilling us in terms of all different aspects of life, the financial system would be sort of like the last frontier of government control, and I'd hate to see it. I'm not sure that they'll get away with it, or at least I don't know how much it will proliferate under a Trump administration. I think, I'll be honest with you, it's movements like that, the sense that the government was taking too much control of our lives, and this government was so mistrusted by the American people that led to the election of Donald Trump. You know, it's hard to put your arms around it all. But I think the fact that American people mistrust its institutions more so than any time in recent memory, it is so off the charts. It was responsible for his first term in 2016. It's not gotten any better. After COVID, it's actually gotten worse. I think the fact that he won the popular and electoral vote, he swept all of the swing states. I do think that that's a mandate, and personally do think that is the result of people looking at both sides, Democrat and Republican, Trump and Harris, and saying, I don't want to go with the party that seems to be more about government control, more about just trust the government, and went with the guy who was the perceived outsider, the one that was trying to stick it to the establishment. You can argue about whether Donald Trump will actually come through with that, but I think that is a reflection of how people feel. And so they just wanted some sort of backstop to what they saw as a sliding encroachment. Now, that's just one person's opinion. You have half the country, half the population of the United States hates Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. They think that the progressive order that the Democrats supposedly represent is the better way for this country, and are very disappointed right now and are very nervous about what awaits them. So I'm only talking from the perspective of somebody who is more inclined to have, I'm more of a civil libertarian. And so my instincts are kind of flow from that. So just keep that in mind for every American.
Yes. Well, I don't think any of us can speak for every American, just like, often an African-American will speak and they'll say, well, this is what African-Americans think, or a gay person right. will speak. And no, there's a variety of thought. And, you know, speaking of libertarians, that was one thing I think that did help Donald Trump a lot, was to go to the libertarian. Was it Pork Fest? He went to one of the conventions.
Didn't go to Pork Fest. He went to Liberty Fest, which I believe was in Las Vegas, with a number of other candidates, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr. at the time, to speak directly to libertarians.
Yeah, and I know that they did boo him, but I think it still did make a difference that he showed up and that he promised to free Ross Ulbricht Silk Road fame. There's a lot of controversy about that, but not really. I think that the controversy is mostly from people who believe everything they read in the mainstream media, but if you look behind it, they're really much like with Assange or with Snowden. The first thing they do is they malign someone if someone is standing or doing something that bucks the system that much.
Right.
But I wondered, he promised that he would free him, so we'll see what happens there. And then hopefully he'll pardon Assange as well, and possibly Snowden. But I don't think it'll happen with Snowden, because there are too many people within his own cabinet that would be against that.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you look at the people who he's been appointing over the last week, and they're not exactly the people who would be pushing for a pardon for Russ Albrecht or Snowden or Assange. So it's really going to be up to him. And again, this is the mixed bag that we're getting with Trump. And you know, if you go right down to the rub of it, he's not a libertarian. He's not even a real conservative. He's a populist. Mm-hmm. And as such, he can go in several different directions at any point of time. The one thing that Trump seems to have his finger on is the pulse of the American public at any given moment. And he showed that by winning this election. He was saying all the things that the folks in those swing states in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan and others wanted to hear, whereas the Democrats were, you know, focus grouping and poll testing and were sort of creating these message campaigns that weren't ringing true with people. And I think Trump has this ability to see what's going on. I mean, he was actually speaking to Arab Americans and telling them that he would bring peace to the region. And then he turns around and he puts a bunch of people in his office who really don't have the best that's the interests of Palestinians and Arabs in their portfolios. But he knew at that given moment that Harris was very weak with those populations, that she was bleeding votes among those demographics in key states like Michigan. And, you know, he had no compunction of going out there and speaking directly to them, just like he didn't have any compunction about going out and speaking directly to libertarians about the things that were important to them. Now we just got to see if he follows through with any of that. I don't want to be a naysayer and say he's not going to follow through. I never second guess anything that Donald Trump is going to do. And I hope that his better angels win out on these issues, whether it be Ukraine, the Middle East, you know, pardon for Assange. But, you know, he can be very mercurial. And so, you know, it's not over. He can continue to put some restrainers in his cabinet and civil libertarians. I think, you know, unlike Lula's wife, I don't have an aversion to Elon Musk. I feel like, yeah, I mean, like everybody else in the real world, he has issues and has problems and things that I don't agree with. But I think, you know, personally, I'll say this right now. I think his takeover of Twitter was not a bad thing and creating the new X. I think that for me, the social media platform, Twitter, under its previous ownership and leadership, had allowed too much government control and a lot and pushing and bullying them to take down accounts and take down tweets and whatnot during that whole COVID cycle. And this all came out in the Twitter files, thanks to Matt Taibbi and others. You know, so I feel like the takeover, has it been seamless? Is it great? Is he always a champion for free speech? No, but I do think that he probably saved it from being an arm of the U.S. government. So I just think, you know, you have to look realistically at all and pragmatically about the events that are unfolding and try to not speculate too much about what Trump and his cadre are going to do.
I agree. And I think that even though I agree with everything you said about Elon Musk, I do know that he's also a military contractor to a certain extent, which is not a great thing, but because it means that he gets money from that. But ultimately, I think that the whole focus on individuals is something that is becoming more and more on the left. Whereas on the right, it's on policies, ideas. Mm-hmm. So you might not even like somebody, but if you like their policies, and I always say, don't look at what somebody says, look at what they do. Trump puts his foot in his mouth all the time, but he also is unfiltered, and that's what people like because they're tired of this politi-speak, and at least you know what you're getting with Trump. I still have no clear idea of what Kamala stood for or what she believes in besides joy and fighting against hate, but that's not a plan, that's not a policy nationally or internationally, and people in this country are suffering. If we were prosperous, if the economy was booming, she might have won, but we weren't, you know. And
point.
Yeah.
A lot of the cards were stacked against them, against her from the outset. The economy was the biggest one. People were just disenchanted, and they continue to be distrustful of the government itself. And so she's representing a very, very unpopular Washington establishment at the same time we're trying to sell herself as an agent of change, and it didn't work. I actually feel for her because she was put in a quite an impossible situation. And maybe if they had engineered or asked or and Biden had acquiesced to stepping down earlier from the nomination, and then they had a full process and a full vetting of candidates, and maybe she would have won out. I just feel like it might have given her extra layers of I don't know, people would have been able to identify her, like you said, and her policies a little better. But instead, you know, starting out in August and trying to build a persona and a portfolio, you know, in that short amount of time. And like I said, Trump, whatever he did, and maybe, you know, probably his campaign manager, Susie Wiles, who is his new chief of staff. I mean, she took his floundering campaign in August and turned it around. And so, so I have to give them credit too. It wasn't just Kamala, bad candidate. The Trump campaign actually turned itself around. After Biden dropped out, it seemed to be, they don't have Biden, the sort of doddering old president incumbent to fight against now. And now it's this like new energized female Black candidate who's getting everybody excited over of joy and change and whatnot and historical, you know, the prospect of this big historical moment. And it didn't look too good. And something happened where they it kind of clicked and they were able to overcome all of that by talking directly to those constituents that were going to get them over the top in those swing states.
Yes. And basically, I think a lot of Trump's policies or strategy was just say yes to everybody, anybody and everybody who wants to talk to you. Theo Vaughn, which was a crazy interview where Theo, and he ended up interviewing Theo about his drug addiction. And that was a big part of it. But just say yes to everybody, whereas Kamala was not meeting with everybody and was spending money like a drunken sailor, and ended up with a very much in debt. And from what I understand, she's still sending out emails trying to get people to help her pay back the campaign because it's in so much debt. And I don't know how that's going to work. Do they file for bankruptcy or what exactly happens there? I don't know if you know the comedian Tim Dillon.
No.
He's kind of a wild card, but a really funny guy. But he said, you know, considering that Kamala was a candidate with no policies and no firm beliefs, she ran a great campaign. If you don't stand for anything, then it's really tough to campaign. But I want to thank you so much. Where can people find your writing and where can people find you? I'm going to put this on X along with YouTube, Rumble, and the audio on iVoox, and I definitely want to have you back. You're so smart and so well spoken, and I don't generally have many interviews in English, but I think that my audience will definitely want to hear this, and of course, you know, people speak English everywhere, and if they can't understand, subtitles will be available as well.
That's wonderful. I appreciate it. And thank you for all the kind words. So I'm with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, but I am the editor of our magazine, Responsible Statecraft, which isn't just a literary platform for the think tank. It's actually a magazine that encourages different voices that are in the vein of restraint. Meaning, how do we change our foreign policy to be less militaristic and more diplomatic? And also serving as a critic an alternative to Washington establishment foreign policy. And so that means, you know, anything from regional, you know, analysis. I mean, we are covering what's going on in Africa, as well as Latin America and Europe, Ukraine war, Middle East, but also Washington politics, and providing sort of like that independent, like, pushback against the mainstream media, the legacy media, like, you know, and this is a great time because, like you pointed out, mainstream media is really floundering as, like, the new realities of social media, podcasts, online platforms have really taken over. And we've done very well, I feel, because there just isn't a lot of online platforms for, like, alternative foreign policy. So that's where you can find my work and so many other writers who are much more articulate than me and more specialized. But yeah, responsiblestatecraft.org. And I also write a lot for the American Conservative, which is also one of the few conservative platforms that are promoting a restrained and realist foreign policy. So they're very interesting in that regard too.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, thank you again. And definitely I will be inviting you back because I'm sure this is going to be an interesting year and a lot to talk about.
Yeah, I would love to share my insights with you and your audience on what is to be in the new Trump administration.
That sounds great. Well, thanks again. And thank you to all our listeners. And we will see you next time.